Okay, so you managed to sit through all of that before. Now you know my MO. I have all the things to tell you. It's not going to be easy to keep it down to less than an hour, but I will try. But so we're going to go on a roller coaster through the four secrets of destruction-proofing your family. Yay, five secrets there are, I tell you. So we have some bonus secrets. I do see two gentlemen here. I have several disclaimers to my talk. The first one is going to be that I have given this talk to couples. When I know there are men present, I do kind of give the male side of it as well. Obviously, it takes two to not destroy their family. But I'm not going to dwell on that part too much. Also, gentlemen, you're under honor not to hold any of this against your wife, since you're here. I always feel like I don't want him to know that I'm trying these things. I'm trying to be nice. He can't know that I'm trying to be nice. That would be. Another disclaimer that I have is, who knows, like, I'm not a social scientist, I don't have the data, you know, there's no footnotes to this talk. I'm going to tell you what I've seen. I've been married for 38 years. I have seen families, some of them of dear friends of mine, be destroyed. So I'm telling you what my experience is. I'm not telling you, like, how I think marriages should be. I'm telling you how marriages are from my seat, and that's the best I can do. Other thing is that, guess what? We all have free will. So when I say destruction-proofing, I'm using that, I don't know if you know many people in Special Forces. I happen to weirdly know many people who are in Special Forces in the military. And basically, this is what you do. You know, you go into training, and they tell you, like, I have a friend who's a Navy SEAL, and he comes up to me. He was a point man in his platoon, and he's, like, super, super nervous and counts all the trees. As soon as he comes into an area, he, like, knows all the trees in my yard that I don't know. Like, he takes in all the data, you know, and he knows where to go and where the mines are. And he, you know, one time he turned to me, and he said, Lila, you want me to drown-proof your kids? And I was like, yeah, I mean, I think that would be a good thing to do. He never did end up doing it, but, I mean, does that mean that nobody ever drowns? No, they do drown. But you gotta do your best to try. You can't just not teach your children to swim. You might even think about having someone tell them, like, take them out to the deep end and do a couple of things to be like, could you get yourself free of the weeds? Maybe it's worthwhile thinking about. And I'm not saying that it might not happen. And, you know, it's terrible, but don't think. I'm saying if you do these things, everything will be great and you'll ride off into the sunset and things will be wonderful, because you and I know that there is a lot of suffering in this world. And the suffering is because of our free will. And actually, God believes more in our free will than we do ourselves. And that's why he allows so many bad things to happen. Nevertheless, the family is God's plan. And even in the natural state, even without the benefit of the sacrament, he has a mind for the family to survive. That is in his plan. With the sacrament, he wants the family to survive. Now, all of you have read magazines. You know all the things that people say. I'm not going to say all the things that people say in the magazines, because you know all those things. Some of them are not actually that great advice. We may talk about that a little bit. But the good things are good, and you know you can tell whether they're good or not, and you can do them, and that's fine. I'm giving you some other things. So when you're young, I just kind of want to give you a little warning. Don't make the mistake of thinking that this stress that you have with your littles is all there is and all there is going to ever be. I know it's super obnoxious for someone to say that it goes by really fast, and I don't want to be that person. But don't think that, on the one hand, you know, your choices just don't matter. Don't think that it doesn't matter, that you not try to change how you do things. Don't think you'll be stuck there forever. Yes, we have to form habits. We have to discipline our children. It's a mistake to try to pacify your children. You can't just leave family culture up to whatever. Oh, like as if it doesn't take thought and habits and love and talking to each other and work. It does. Don't fall into the mistake of thinking, well, later when they're all older, then we'll think about how we want our family to be. Someone once took a survey and asked some parents, like, when did they think that it would be a good time to start forming family culture and getting their kids to do certain things, and a lot of the majority of the people said at age 16. But it's also, so, you know, yeah, we have to start really young, but we can't think that they'll be irrational forever. We have to demand behavior right away, but we can't think that there's going to be perfect behavior. If you've ever met a three-year-old, I don't know how you would think that. This is real life. So what I would like to say is that all of that happens when children are very young. We struggle with ourselves, we struggle with them, but a time will come when the children are older and they are interacting with each other, they're interacting with you, and they're no longer unconscious. And all of that takes self-control that for ourselves and for them, and we're all learning together. As we're teaching our children self-control, we are gaining self-control. So it's not like first we're going to get self-control and then they're going to get it doesn't work that way. People always said to me, oh, you have seven children, you must be so patient. If my husband were here, you know how your husband, your spouse, knows your one major defect. My husband is like, oh, yeah, I know your one major defect. Lacking patience. So I would say there are like the slacker families and the perfectionist families. So the slacker families are kind of like, oh yeah, it's just the way it is, I don't know, it's how it is. And the perfectionist families are the one-year-old and the three-year-old and the five-year-old are going to sit perfectly around and I'm going to put all my effort and energy into it, and it is and if dinner does not go well, I have failed. So, slacker or perfectionist, you can be thinking amongst yourselves which ones you are. Here's the problem with experts. Experts, do experts have families? I feel like experts do not have families. I mean, I'm saying, like, when I look up the experts and I look up their bios, they don't actually seem to have, maybe they have two children. A lot of times when their two children get older, they change what they were saying before, and they kind of say, well, actually, it doesn't really matter. There's not much you can do. Well, I don't agree with that. So I'm not an expert, but I do have a family. So these are my secrets. We're going to go through the first two a little fast because we did touch on them in the previous talk. I have posts and posts and posts about these two things. So if you are not getting what I'm saying, just go to likemotherlikedaughter.org and you will find what I'm saying. So number one, and it's basically in the order that I posted them, so that's my order. If you want to know, like, well, what order are you putting these in? Most important, less important, whatever. No, basically how I posted them. So the first one, the first secret is to live your Sunday as a day of worship, rest, and celebration. No matter what. This is a commandment. There are 10 commandments. So you really, it's not like there's a gazillion commandments, there's 10. So really this one is the one that we owe God as a duty, but also it is the one that will cause and create the most flourishing. So if we want to grow and flourish and become the human being that God wants us to be, which is to say divine, to have life with him in heaven as a saint, you know that only saints are in heaven, right? Yikes. So that means we must worship him on Sunday. We must rest. It cannot be another day to get things done, although you will do things. We're not Sabbatarians. I'm not a Sabbatarian. I'm not an Orthodox Jew. We do things, but the idea is you are relaxing somehow, at least for an hour. You are resting. You are celebrating. It should be that day. This gives us orientation to what is true, good, and beautiful, and it gives us the ability to see things as they are. Without our Sunday rest, we will not see things as they are. And so we will constantly be misguided. So, Sunday. Sunday is the heart of the liturgical year, but it is not the only thing in the liturgical year. So as soon as all the things I'm saying, you don't have to remember them all except for rest on Sunday, because once you rest for that day, all the other things will come to you, and you'll realize, and God in His grace will send His Holy Spirit, and the things will come to you, and they'll enlighten your mind, and you'll suddenly realize all sorts of things about Christmas, and how important Christmas is, and how all the great theologians, the most amazing, smart, and insightful theologian you can imagine, every Christmas kneels at the altar, at the cradle, kneels before the creche, sees baby Jesus in his cradle, and knows the deepest knowledge of what it is that God has tried to tell us by this event. We have to prepare for Christmas, and that's the season of Advent. We must celebrate Christmas, and we must come to know that Christmas is for the whole universe and for every creature in it, and that is Epiphany. And then we have a little bit of time to absorb that and to have our Sundays of rest and worship and celebration, and then Lent comes, and then Easter, and that is the liturgical year, and that is how we will have our family life, and it will be the best it can be. The second secret is dinner together. As soon as you set this goal of Sunday, you quickly notice how impossible it is going to be to have your relaxation and celebration with each other without having eaten as a family at least 4 days of the week that are not Sunday, so that you can work on it, so to speak, because doing things easily and naturally comes with practice. Not to say that, I mean, each day with its dinner is going to be a delight. And this is who we are as a family. Real life is meeting. Time stops. We gather together because we love each other. We know each other. We love each other. We solve our problems at the dinner table with humor and with sacrifice for each other. We appreciate the food that is, however simple it is lovingly prepared. If you are the slacker family, you will not get there because you don't like each other. So you're going to be, like, by the time your children are getting towards, like, the oldest child is now 11 or 12. I'm not talking here about three-year-olds. If you need to know about three-year-olds, I do have posts about that. Let's just right now think about, like, oh, that time that you think is never going to come, where you have a 16-year-old, a 14-year-old, and whatever. And if you're a slacker family, you just don't really like each other that much, because never having set standards or created order, never having cultivated manners, never addressing pleasant speaking voices, never having addressed sitting still, listening to each other, you will indeed have no enjoyment. And enjoyment is basically the result of a lot of background work. That's just all it comes to. And all that work takes place at the family table. It is a work of joy. It's beautiful. Yes, there are days when you just cannot believe it, and you're sitting across from your husband, and you literally, there is a wall of sound between the two of you, and there's nothing you can do. However, trust me, if you abandon the slacker mentality, you will get there. The perfectionist family, remember, it's not just the slacker families, there are the perfectionist families, having nagged and yelled and despaired and demanded nothing less than perfection from their 2-year-old and their 4-year-old, will become so tired out that by the time your kids are 16, 15, whatever, you'll just be burnt out, and your husband will not be able to please you, and your wife is a shadow of her former self. Your children want to get out because they can't take it anymore. And everybody becomes involved in activities because actually home is not a very pleasant place to be. This is the paradox of family life. The paradox that will lead us to not distracting, which is that on the one hand, we need to set standards and expect them to be met. And simultaneously, without letting go of that vision, we also should not despair over meltdowns, naughtiness, wiggling, squabbling, and chaos. This requires a sense of humor. You just have to have a sense of humor. And then you'll make it to the second decade, and there will be your payoff, because now you will be enjoying each other. And that will be lovely. So everything you do is practice for everything else. Have dinner together, which means we have to have a place for dinner. They need to help you. This is not all on you, that you have to somehow throw out the tablecloth and poof, everything is there. Everybody has to help come in. Even the two-year-old can toddle in with the napkins and bring daddy his napkin. Light the candles, sit down, take a breath, and pray. If you need to restart all of this, if all of this is like a kind of a, to you, I mean, I feel like actually all of you all do this, and you all could stand up here and give this talk, and I should just sit down. But if there is someone here who feels like, well, oh, no, I'm not doing any of that. The beautiful thing is that the liturgical year gives us many occasions to start again, to begin again. And the two preeminent occasions for that are Advent and Lent. And if you're thinking to yourself, like, oh, but what penances be? Like, should we have just bread and water? Or should we go on our knees, pray the all four rosaries on our knees? How about that you, this is the penance for Advent, this is the penance for Lent, that you think about some of these things and make dinner the thing that you actually want it to be, the moment of your day that you actually want it to be, with everyone's help. So I do have a few strategies for this, and I'm going to just probably they're all on my blog. I'll go through them very quickly. The children don't have to sit with you for very long if they're not very old. That's fine. They don't have to stop. They come, sit down, say grace, eat. 10 minutes later, you may be excused. Mama, may I be excused? Say, Mama, may I be excused? Yes, you may. Everyone has to be polite. If the children are screaming at you because they hate the bleepity bleep food, well, that's not an issue of pickiness, that's an issue of manners. Everyone has to be polite. No one should speak to anyone else in that tone of voice. So we start there. One conversation. This is the cornerstone of my life at the dinner table. This is a vital aspect of courtesy. I cannot overemphasize the long-term benefits of this strategy. One meeting, as my husband's boss that he had when he got married would say, one meeting. He did not suffer side conversations lightly. At home, my husband would pull the table together by saying one conversation. And I'm going to tell you the reasons. This is on the top 10 list of the great things my husband has done for our family to make it my kind of family. First of all, it's just survival. The din would be too much without this role. Second, it makes it possible for conversation to occur in a reasonable, civilized way. If you allow multiple conversations, you are effectively allowing multiple fights. Including hitting. It develops the skill of listening, a skill more in demand than in supply. Listening is a habit. Habits are formed at the home, usually at the dinner table. Fourthly, where there is a conversational free-for-all, this is what happens. The people who are the most dominant take over. They end up only talking to each other. Less assertive family members stay mute or in a truly terrible development, pick off other non-alphas for side discussions, leading to that worst of social offenders, the picker-offer. You know, the person who can't join the general discussion in a party but insists on engaging you, the person who wants to be part of this conversation, pulls you off to the side and in a low voice, one-on-one, using their body language, turns you away from what is going on, and to tell you something, I mean, they are just party poopers. And the party poopers are bred in families who don't have the one conversation rule. They are compensating, not very well, for never having been trained in the art of discussion with multiple people, and very often they are from larger families, but ones without a strong orchestrator of the conversation. That orchestrator really needs to be your husband, and he really needs to be encouraged if he doesn't necessarily happen to think that this is something that occurs to him, but he needs to be encouraged to do that and to bring the family together in one conversation. I had a reader who interpreted this as that there needed to be one topic of conversation that we chose beforehand, and that would be the thing we were talking about. No, not at all. I don't care what the topic of conversation is. It can be anything. That's not the point. The point is that when one person is speaking, everybody else is listening. The other good thing about one conversation is that the good leader has a good awareness of the less dominant types and includes them, giving them their chance to speak. So that awareness can actually be facilitated by mother's little gesture to the father across the table, like, a lot of times dominance correlates with age, not always, but sometimes it does. And with my husband's technique, the youngest or somehow weakest child, having indicated a desire to say something, can't be drowned out or shouted down. He has his say. He has the floor. Sometimes he doesn't indicate, or in fact, the opposite, he shows real reluctance that he wants to join in, but that's all the more reason for an alert parent to draw him out. Everyone listens respectfully, not having recourse to that destructive solution of saying something to the side. None of that. Thus, even the shyest person at the table has a chance and receives encouragement from the people who, after all, love him. And when that three-year-old says his silly little thing about, you know, the cute things that everybody laughs, but they laugh kindly, and he knows he's loved, and he stores up his sentences, learning to be bolder and to be attended to, and he learns that most important precept of all, that the soul of brevity, of wit, is brevity. It is quite difficult to have mustered up the courage to speak, and is made even more difficult if people are whispering or not paying attention. Nowhere else in our utilitarian world will someone have a chance to run with the big boys that way, but without the danger. And that is what being a family is. It's a safe place to be yourself, to be loved for who you are, not for what you contribute. We just need opportunities to do this, and the dinner table is the really most important daily opportunity for all of this. The one conversation rule facilitates this glorious characteristic of the family, that it is a school of virtue, of people learning to love and serve each other. Children at the dinner table can also be asked simply to stop talking. This is a very good thing to learn, and I'm not only saying this at the dinner table, there's other places too, at the store or whatever. What's holding us back is that we cannot imagine saying to a group of our friends, I'm just going to ask you to be quiet now. Mr. Lawler and I need a chance to talk. But what you're forgetting is that unlike your relationship with your friends, you have authority over your children, who will someday be your friends, but they're also your subjects, and I mean that in a very loving yet royal way. So what would be fairly shocking to your friends is not only appropriate for your children, it is necessary, and I am begging you to employ this strategy. Just ask them to stop talking. One way to do this is to say, not of general interest. That's that great thing from, did you ever read, I think it's in Bells on Their Toes, the dad, Gilbreth, just says, Mr. Gilbreth, he's, well, you know, he's crazy. And if the children were hijacking the conversation, he would just bellow, not of general interest. And many a time have we used that strategy. So we have to be understanding, let the children who aren't interested in talking about the ins and outs of the Exim Bank leave the table if they want to. They can take the milk on their way out. This is fine. And the most important thing is to have one conversation. Everything will be revealed if we do these things with our children. Suddenly, let me just make sure that I am in fact on the right page. Yeah. Suddenly, we will be struck when we just stop and look and talk to our children how rude, unkempt, and dirty and squirmy they are. because we will be listening to them, to some narrative of some cowboy in the spaceship or something, and that we really won't have very much else to think about. And so then we will clean them up, and we will truly hang in there with all of these things, and we will notice that they're actually genuinely far smart and funny, and that they're actually thoughtful. They have learned with our gentle prodding to pay attention to each other, to be sure to pass each other the things that they need for a good supper. They will get things for each other. They will listen politely to each other. And once we wipe their faces, we'll just realize how good it is to be with them. So now I come to my third secret to destruction-proofing your family. I have to do this one before the fourth. You'll see why when I get through it. This one is the somewhat tough one, but we're gonna power through. When I was young, I assumed, because of the situation that I was brought in, that responsible people use birth control, and that only irresponsible, sex-crazed people who were also repressed, and mainly Catholic, did not use birth control. So it's not that I made an effort to believe that birth control was something normal, regular people did. It was a given in how I grew up, and I just always accepted that the fewer children you could have, the happier you would be, and also the better off you would be. You would just be richer. When I found out that the Catholic Church doesn't hold with this idea, and I became a Catholic, I accepted this. And that's simply because I trusted in the church and I trusted in God's word, and I just believed that this was true. However, that's very different from saying that I wasn't afraid, especially since I was 19 when I got married. So the prospect of having 22 children, I was kind of, you know, I think you could forgive me for thinking that that might be a bit much. So, okay, but here I am, nevertheless, with only 7 children. And they're children that I have not gotten without some suffering. I myself almost died in childbirth with my 6th child. And my husband promptly lost his job for the ensuing 18 months. So we have seen the things. I'm not speaking here out of some sanguine ignorance. Our family, like every family, has endured many things that I don't have time today to enumerate. But just don't think that I am naively dismissing the pain and suffering that comes with what the world calls living dangerously, and so it is, no matter what. And I know about the other things, the ones you might face, and I'm here to say something that is just my strong feeling that this thing does not get said. And it is actually not regarded as a viable option in our society, which is this. This is my secret. Husband and wife, embrace your mission as the king and queen of your little kingdom, your family, and enjoy when you want to what we may quaintly and not without relief from the pressure of modern vulgarity refer to as the marital embrace. Simply accepting the children God sends you as the gift that they are. This ought not to be, and yet it is, in this day of a sad lack of collective memory, a hard saying. So, if you're still with me after the shock, I'm going to point out a few things that you might not have thought of. Things have not worked out the way contraception boosters predicted. Even a quick survey would be outside the scope of this talk, but I'm not going to go into all the things, but you will know what I am talking about. I certainly would not need to be here to tell you secrets to protect your family and its very existence if it were not the case that things are very bad. It's this sense of looming and indeed present disaster that we can't shake, even with the brazen promises of modern science. Everyone spends a lot of time trying to assure us that things are not that bad and are about to be truly wonderful, but if we look at one simple metric, the child's sense of security in growing up 60 years ago in an intact family, the strongest predictor of health and success and happiness that there is. Even a poor child, even a child of color, for instance, versus today, there is no question that things are spiraling down and there's no hope of rescue from the world. The second thing that I just feel things does, the second thing that I feel does not get said is that contraception is not magic, although we talk of it as it as if it is. Even those who believe in the church's teaching and who believe that the church has her way of helping families, we talk as if contraception is magic and that it's just magic that we're forbidden to use. But actually, there are two kinds of contraception. There's the kind that doesn't really work at all to prevent pregnancy, and there's the kind that works at tremendous cost. Of that kind, the kind that works at tremendous cost, there are two kinds. The kind that works not always over time, certainly, because it chemically alters the woman's body in frightening ways, rendering it inhospitable to the child. And then there's the kind that mutilates the body and still doesn't always work. And then there's abortion, which is the evil mop-up squad of failed contraception. So no, contraception is not magic. So that way is going to be inherently bitter, and it will take its toll, and it is a bargain with the enemy. Despite most of us seeing the reality of the first thing I said, which is that things are very bad, despite all the promises that if we broke God's law, and even though most of us wrestle with number two, that contraception isn't magic and can hurt us and or our unborn babies very badly in many ways, we almost can't help ourselves giving, when our own case is involved, what is as reflexive a response as a tap on the knee with a rubber hammer. Auntie Lila, what about the need to limit family size? And I call this reflex, this reaction, baby resistance. And maybe because this is the words of a wise priest I know will help put this into perspective. He told me that in his long experience, as a very old priest, in his long experience, most couples sought his help with natural family planning due to their inability to have children. In other words, if we removed the near universal use of birth control, we would not see every couple having the maximum amount of children posited by a biology textbook and popular imagination. And although people would like us to think this, the reality is very different. Like everything else, there's a curve to this thing. Some couples, yes, will have a lot of children, and we do notice those people more. We just do. And some would have none, and those we don't really notice as much. And the majority would fall somewhere along that curve, having maybe 2 to 5 children. I don't know. I don't have any hard data, but neither does anybody else. So let's just think about it. Just to think of all the variables without even counting the fertility of each of the spouses, which would also have to combine in the right way, the age when they got started, the illness, the separation, like work, deployments, not talking about getting mad at each other, accidents, and the almost completely forgotten natural built-in mechanism of breastfeeding that spaces babies. Everyone is baby resistant. That is our built-in cultural response. We resist babies, but how do you know that you will have another child? What if you could see your life from God's perspective, could know that He would only send you one more child or none? Would you act differently? Yet all the medical advice we get, all the advice from relatives and friends, is premised on the opposite assumption that you will get pregnant if you don't take steps to prevent it. Well, real life says otherwise. There are folks at the other end of the curve, and what if they are you? Is a child actually something to be resisted? If we're going to be questioning things, can we start there? I think that when we collectively agreed that marriage can be taken or left as a society, when we just said marriage may or may not, it's just not, it's just a construct, Then we made the child the scapegoat and the locus of all our anxiety. But in the context of the family, the child is always pure gift. Get rid of something else if you are struggling before you put up a defense against the child. You were a child. When you step away from that little matrix of assumptions that you will get pregnant without constant protection and that a baby is somehow on some fundamental level something that you should resist, you might catch a glimpse of the consequences of thinking that way. My secret is actually just God's plan for marriage. You will find relief from the constant pressure of worrying that a child will derail your plans or make you poorer or sicker. The constant anxiety of worrying that your method of preventing conception will fail. The wear and tear on your relationship with each other, not perhaps quite noticeable when you are young, but later on when the children are busy and older, the wear will start to show as you approach each and every encounter with your spouse with an underlying sense of repelling the inner meaning of your actions. And it's this last thing that I think nobody really discusses. Unless you've lived through it, the days and years of running past each other to get to soccer practices and dance recitals and meetings of the planning board and shift changes and bosses' unreasonable requests and the flu going through the house and operations that you had to have and bouts with cancer, it's hard to explain that marriage is not the simple cost-benefit calculation between sex and babies that it looks like when you're very young. Most people will assume that you'll have your 2.0 children and then you will only have to cope with all of those things I mentioned for a few years and then it's easy street for the two of you, but is that how it really works out? I just don't think that people realize that when you get to be in your late 40s, your fight against babies ends up being exhausting and it's pointless and has drained your life, your married life, of meaning. You can't have predicted that a baby, should one be granted to you, multiplies love, even as it complicates things because, of course, many good things are complicated in this fallen world of ours. You certainly will not at that time of your life have the mental energy to fend off people who simply say no to babies. You're used to being baby resistant, but you might find out that you don't actually like it as much as you thought it would. You can't project or know any of that when you're young. You cannot know what it is like to be older and have lived your life that way. Only I have survived to tell you. And I say that because of the people I have seen whose marriages have failed over this very cause. What I see is that the fight against babies makes you suspicious against each other. It divides you. It prevents friendship. It is something that we cannot have known that any advice that would be targeted at our relationship that is about being less nagging, kinder, more loving, more generous, will have not much effect if the very purpose of our life together has been frustrated. What good is there in knowing our temperament or love language or any number of habits for success if at the most fundamental level our communication is compromised? When the language of your body is at odds with the language of your intentions, how can you find a way out? I get really impatient with all the marital advice when it doesn't address the main point of marriage, which is to build a family. And a family is a unit of glory by means of your bond. God may or may not send children, but if you've closed off his very intention at the source, how can you hope to catch any other graces? There's no other area in our life where we just assume that God got it wrong, and that he made us wrong. Yes, we fell. Nevertheless, can we not trust that he would get this right, this most important thing? When you remove all this frustration and distress by committing to enjoying each other when you want to, accepting children who come with trust, you align your marriage and your married life with its purpose, you will find peace. It won't be peaceful peace, because in a stunning revelation, life is not easy. What if, in fact, you are one of those couples at the other end of the curve with lots and lots of children? You will still be frustrated just like everyone else, and you will probably suffer terrible things. Of course. Everybody suffers. What if your carefully planned little reasonable family doesn't materialize at all? All I'm saying is don't be fooled. Especially where there is a time limit to your awareness potential, aka biological clock, the point beyond which all this will be moot, and you'll merely be living together with the consequences of whatever your stance has been. But there's suffering and there's suffering. I just would rather not have the kind of suffering that comes from trying to avoid suffering by refusing a treasure. The child is a treasure. If you've ever read any good stories at all, you will know that you had best choose the path that is in alignment with your true quest, come what may, not the path you think will help you avoid suffering. Destruction proofing is a paradoxical undertaking. What if we did the unheard of and looked at the baby question and just said something like, God in his word tells us that children are a gift? What if we have joy? So these are the disclaimers. I have no guarantee. I do not know. Destruction can come despite all our efforts. We're just doing our best. I'm not really discussing natural family planning here. I don't actually like discussing natural family planning because I always feel that it gets out of control very quickly. I'm completely in line with the teachings of the church. All I'm saying is that I am trying to address the idea of child resistance that's ingrained in us. And to try to help everyone see that we could possibly just simply live a different way. And for those who are on the part of the curve where having children is difficult, NFP holds the surest help for sure, which is unsurprising since it's the only inquiry into fertility that doesn't try to bludgeon it. So I'm happy with everybody going and learning more. But this is the main point, which is that most married people simply have not considered nor been encouraged in what actually ought to be the default position for those who love each other, which is to accept the babies that come and maximizing thereby the preservation of our family. Now, this is the fourth secret. This is how I can get to the fourth secret. I couldn't give it to you without giving you that one. This is the one where we just are friends. We're friends with each other. And we live differently, as Pope Benedict told us. Those who have hope live differently. It is for husbands and wives to be friends with each other. And how can that happen in our intimate life together if we are treating our most precious gift of ourselves as a threat? But what does it mean to be friends? Friends admire each other. Friends choose to be together. And friends are polite to and considerate of each other. The husband and the wife, when they are first married, they do tend to be friends. They're lovers and they're expected to feel like lovers and to go on that way forever. But my thoughts are about dealing with the everyday and maybe when those fires die down. And I really prefer to talk about it in terms of this friendship, because friends treat every time they are to come into contact with a certain kind of eagerness. They animate their voices to express their anticipation. They smile with shared adventure. They make sure that the other knows that the encounter is appreciated, though they rarely discuss their mutual affection. Now think of husbands and wives. Think about how your voice sounded over the phone. Was it flat and merely informative? Did you convey a smile in your voice? Did you sign off warmly? How do you walk through the room where your spouse is busy? Do you interrupt heedlessly? Do you make eye contact in a friendly way? Think about how friends laugh at each other's quips. I mean, I feel like guys laugh at each other's lame puns all the time. But do husbands and wives laugh at the things that each other say? I think that if the men were here, I would have a few things to say to them about. I do have two gentlemen here. So I will say every once in a while, just go ahead and laugh at something humorous that your wife might be saying to you. You'll make her day. I would say that if we thought about how the enjoyment that we get with our friends really is proportional to the effort that we put into it. What if we bring a little of that energy to our interaction with our husband? Give him a little admiration, at least a proportional amount of sparkly eyes and peppy conversation. Offer him one fraction of the consideration you give to your pals. When I put it that way, doesn't it seem a bit silly to stint him? Here's the thing, it's really hard to be with someone for years and years and not see all their flaws exclusively. Only an effort at admiration will overcome this tendency to devolve into a flaw-noticing machine. Want to survive with your marriage intact? This is it. This is the secret. Marriage is a mutual admiration society. For some reason, we're always, with our friends, we're aware of how our own flaws must seem very evident to them, yet with our spouses, we are the opposite. We assume that only his shortcomings are noticeable, and our behavior is the gold standard. This leads me to a much more serious aspect of this, which is to say that once you get into despise mode and only expressing contempt, it is very unlikely that you will survive destruction. Contempt is the one thing that is very hard to forgive and to stop. Don't get to that point. At the minimum, the person you married accepts you. Who else would? I don't kid myself that there's anyone else. Of course, my husband is very far from vexing. He's amazing and treats me very, very well, which makes it all the more astounding that he puts up with me. So here's the practical part. Men and women need to be admired in different ways. These are ways that are based on my own experience. You can discuss with each other, husband and wife, how is it, dear, that you like to be admired? But I would say that, yes, there are certain particular things that people need in order to feel that they are admired. But to wives, I would say that, I would warn you that a man must be loved as a man. Does your husband know that you admire him as a man? Meaning even his strength, his physical strength, that he knows that he is admirable in your eyes, you would need to really look at him with approbation and admiration, and specifically for being strong and protective, for taking care of you and your probably numerous, if you followed my third secret, family. Why do we withhold this blessing from our man? Why do we refrain from openly admiring him? Try giving him that look that says, you are my man. The other day, I saw a woman rolling her eyes. It was a couple I knew, and they were at a distance from me. This wasn't the other day. I wrote this when it was the other day. It was years ago. I saw them, and I saw her rolling her eyes in exaggerated disgust at her husband's clumsiness. Something trivial, I assure you. Something that she would have bent over backwards to cover up if it had been a friend of hers committing this gaffe. I knew at that moment that their marriage was toast. That's the test, isn't it? What would it profit you to treat your friends with patience if your own husband can't make a mistake without the world knowing about it? Has there been bitterness between you? I'd be surprised if not. But try admiration first and then work your way up to forgiveness, rather than thinking that admiration and friendship will come later when you've sorted things out. When you mess up, forgive each other readily. When there's a problem, address it in a friendly way with a sense of humor rather than criticism. If there's something that you need to repeat, some people would call that nagging. Try teasing or exaggerating wildly. I also like to say, nagging is when you haven't done the thing. Anything rather than exasperation that dwindles to simple nagging. So the sad fact is that most people with marriage issues do not realize until they are long into a dull state of entitlement combined with a good amount of rudeness. We expect a self-help book or date night to sort things out when in reality, that all that will only help if we've grappled with some of what seem to be ordinary moments and put some spunk into them. Are you friends? Do you laugh together? Do you admire each other? That's the key. That's the secret. All right, real quick, because I'm way over. Bonus secret. Ritual. Ritual. This is something I really wanted to talk to you about. I'm still working out how to say this, but I would like to ask you if, in fact, spontaneity is actually all it's cracked up to be. All of nature obeys a ritual. Man experiences great anxiety where he must continually invent spontaneous ways to do things. So-called spontaneous, unrehearsed moments often end up being their own rituals. They're just unexamined rituals. Is it wise to take advice from our culture? Auntie Lila, you need to be done. Okay. I just went to a wedding where the bridesmaid's toast, I really feel like she just downloaded it from the internet. Like, she looked up what to say as a bridesmaid, and it was all like, live, laugh, love, be yourself, follow your dream, do whatever occurs to you, be spontaneous, you know. And it's kind of, I was sitting there going, do you know what wedding this is? Because I can tell you that everybody here does not agree with you. But I started thinking about it, and I started thinking, why is that, yeah, be spontaneous, really? So, like, date night is supposed to be the panacea. It's supposed to be the expression of creativity that breaks us out of the routine of life, daily life. But then why do so many date nights resemble each other? Why do we have to be told exactly what to do on date night? I mean, it's fine. Go on a date night. That's fine. But all I'm saying is that I would just worry a little bit if all the advice for intimacy is all about spontaneity. But we really question who is giving this advice. Cardinal Ratzinger, when he's talking about the liturgy, says, and remember, marriage is a liturgical event. So he's talking about the liturgy in church, and he's saying, liturgy that is manufactured in this way, with the eye to spontaneity, remains totally empty, however much human artistry may adorn it. Only respect for the liturgy's fundamental unspontaneity and pre-existing identity can give us what we hope for, the feast in which the great reality comes to us, that we ourselves do not manufacture but receive it as a gift. Is it possible that family life, too, needs a sense of identity that we return to? It's identity that as a husband and wife, we have free rein to make the way we want it to be within the limits of what's given as man and woman. Of the comforting ritual for the husband and the wife without the burden of always needing to come up with something new. The most delightful dances, for instance, are the ones called sets because the steps are set. One knows them. They're choreographed precisely for delight. So my very last point is in the breach, the secret in the breach. When something terrible and out of your control has happened to your family or, since you're very young, may happen to your family, honor marriage in the breach. Marriage has its existence. It is a reality. Sometimes the bad things happen. We are all sinful and broken. It's not with what the world calls a happy or successful marriage or life that we help others, but with trust in the good and the true and honoring the good and the true. These are the secrets to destruction-proofing your children's families as well. When we know that we live our Sunday, we worshiped God, that we had dinner together, that we accepted children lovingly, that we tried to have friendship with our spouse, and that above all, we honored the sacrament of our marriage, our children will learn what true love really is, and they will not only have happiness and destruction-proof their marriages, but they will have trust in God. There is no program, pre-Cana or otherwise, that could ever approach this curriculum of love. If you want to prepare your children for their own family life, do these 4, 5, 6 things I'm telling you. Family, become what you are. With my apologies for making you sit so long. So I do have time for questions, but feel free to be done with me. You've listened to me a lot today.
always be that way, and he is progressing and getting better. But what are your suggestions for trying to still cultivate a stable family life when you are going through the eye of the storm, and it's not a quick storm?
Right. And this will happen to everyone. Like, not everyone has a, you know, and the timing can be different for different people, and it can look different. It could be a physical crisis, it could be an emotional crisis. And it's precisely these secrets that will take us through those times, and maybe those things happened early on. So it's hard, you know, to know that things have not yet been established. But I just think that no matter what, you just have to keep going back to the fundamental things. So, for instance, like, no matter what, even if you were in the hospital all day on a Sunday, there's still, you're going to pray and the Holy Spirit is going to direct you to know how that day is going to be Sunday in the midst of wherever you are. I mean, I have a friend whose husband is a cop, and sometimes he's gone from Saturday night until Monday morning. I mean, they just do the best they can. It's not optional. There's not another day that you can have your Sunday. Sunday is Sunday in the cosmos. Sunday is Sunday. So somehow, in the midst of everything, you just carve out that space. And if you do, God gives you the answers for all the other things. He honors us when we make the tiniest baby step. So can I solve all your problems? I really can't. I don't know the circumstances, and I don't know all the things. And I would bet that you're doing amazingly well, and that you are already, you know, very far down the road of this living and loving and making a community of love and a domestic church. So really, it's now up to the Holy Spirit to show you, like, Lord, how am I gonna do these things? And, you know, admiring your husband in the midst of it. A lot of families do fall apart over a crisis, a health crisis, especially of a child. And why? You have to ask yourself, why would that be? Like, there are, I'm sure of all of you know of a family where something really terrible happened to a child, and not long after, the parents get divorced. Well, your marriage is the foundation of your family. No matter what, you still have to attend to the good of your spouse. It could be that, I mean, the medical profession has its own demands, you know, and it's kind of like, here we are, here's all the tests you have to do, and even if it's a crisis, but it goes out over, you know, months and years and whatever, well, that person who God gave you to take care of, you still do have to take care of him. And everyone has to find their place in the family, and we can't ditch. It's like on the airplane, you know, when they say that when the oxygen masks come on, you have to put your oxygen mask on before you can help the person next to you. They used to say child, but now they're like, if the person next to you needs help, your child. And I would say, like, you have to put that oxygen mask on your marriage before you can actually help your child. So I don't know, maybe somehow the focus went so much to that child that the husband just felt like he wasn't needed anymore. I don't know. I don't know what all the situations are, but the Holy Spirit will guide us, and the Holy Spirit, through the grace of the sacrament of marriage, will show you exactly what it is that you have to do, and you don't have to worry, and you can have a lot of hope. Yes?
I think what I love about the premise of today is an invitation to be imaginative and constructive in the home guided by Mother Church. One thing we haven't talked about, which I think a lot of us probably default to, is looking at the culture and taking up a defensive position. Mm-hmm. Like, to protect the home, mm-hmm. a lot of our energies need to be directed towards limiting the malignant forces that are out there through television, through social media. Are there really deliberate steps that your family has taken as far as saying, like, we are going to mediate these influences and monitor what comes in?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely am on the side of totally protecting. Every organism has to develop according to its nature. So there's no way to kind of circumvent that. So we do, our duty as parents is to protect the children. The amazing thing is that sounds really defensive, but in the meantime, the culture of the family is so incredibly vigorous that what actually happens, because I mean, even though I'm here with white hair, like that was exactly the way it was when my kids were little too. It was totally like, I mean, for us, it wasn't screens, but it was video games. And it was like, why can't we have a video game? And all the families have video games. And if you go over there, you tell me you're going to go play outside, but instead you're inside playing a video game. And it's just like, video games, oh, you know. And but my son, he grew up and he did say to me, Mom, you were right. You were right not to let us have video games. But anyway. but in the meantime, you have your standards, and it sounds so defensive, but in the meantime, your family culture is vigorously growing to the point that everybody is looking at you like, we only have our pitiful like phones. We don't have what you have, which is this like, I don't know, like it could be anything, but you know, like fiddling and putting on plays, like hanging curtains in the doorway and making plays. And somehow your kids seem to know, like they can take care of sheep, or they can make a bonfire. I don't know, like all these things that to us are just normal things, and to everybody else, they're just like, how do you even know about it? Well, we don't know. I didn't know how to do any of those things. You know, they were just like, Mom, we have to do this, you know? And so then you just did it, but it's because you made a space. It's not like the space is a negative space. The space is a positive. It's like you took all the things and you dug them into the soil, and then the plants just grew. And so we, yes, it's like, is it protective? But let's always think of it as super, super positive. We're doing all these things because they are great and wonderful and cause the flourishing of real Christian culture. And then if we can rope in a few other people to do it with us, and you're so blessed because, you know, those of you who live here, you do have this community, you have this center of it, which is the beautiful liturgy and the beautiful church. And so just make that, just cultivate it, and just see when the things are seeping in to just chip away and just resist and be like, Auntie Lila was like, no, that next child is going to be the greatest gift you ever had. So it's like, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, this is just a wonderful, amazing, I mean, I have a friend who I would say like 5 years ago, she was kind of like, well, Lila, I don't know. I mean, you know, I have all these kids. Now she has 6 boys, and they have a, you know, they built a platform in the woods, and they had a workshop for all the kids who wanted to come in the summertime, and they produced the Princess Bride, and it was a ton of fun. I dragged my husband to it, and he was like, we're sitting in the woods, and I'm like, oh, he's going to complain that he couldn't hear or whatever, and afterwards, he's like, it's the best, it was the best, it was so much fun. And now they have that platform out there, and so now they're doing, like, they did the Princess Bride with some, like, swing dances thrown in, which was really cute. But one of the, you know, this is like the fertility, like, there's one kid who really knew how to all the swing dances, so she taught everybody. Well, now they're using that platform as a dance platform. So now these kids, hello, have we ever heard today in 2017 that there's a bunch of 18, 17, 16, 15-year-olds who are getting together on a Saturday in the woods on a platform to have swing dances and then have a bonfire and then go up to the house and have some cider? And like that's literally in 5 years, they went from, I don't know, what am I doing, to, oh, here it is, you know? And It's just going to be great. We just have to believe. That's all. It's going to be great. Yes?
I'm sorry if I'm making you repeat yourself too much, but do you have any further advice on dealing with the nagging anxiety that maybe the rest of the world is right, that we're shortchanging our children somehow by having to...
Oh, yeah, they're super right. Like, the epidemic of why are people dying from opioid overdose? It's because they are empty inside. They are empty. What is it that we are refusing our children? That emptiness? Like, no, absolutely not. They're right because they're out there, you know, with, I don't know, like just doing all, I mean, I don't have to list it to you. It's terrible. It's terrible. We're giving our children room. We gave them another sibling. We gave them room. We gave them space. I mean, you know, honestly, the world actually is hungry for the bright-eyed people to come and to be like, yeah, we can solve that problem. May I fix my dad's tractor? I can do that. Or, you know, like, oh, yeah, yeah, in our family, we had to figure out how to, like, add on the bath, the handicapped bathroom, so that my mother, my grandmother could come with us. Yeah, we can do that. You know, like, the world is hungry for that. I can tell you, like, my children are grown up now. And honestly, I do. I kind of feel like, I don't know, I mean, I didn't do a great job homeschooling them. I don't know. I didn't teach them. But somehow, they can do the things. And people, they're in great demand. People are always, they're the ones that people want to go to and say, well, can you do this? And like my son is a real people person, people are always asking him to solve problems. And half the time he'll just be like, Mom, it was just like, yeah, like when you live with so many people, you just learn. Like what? You can totally size up someone's mental state. And it's because as a young, you know, one of the youngest in their family, he just had to for survival. Oh, here it comes, I better, you know. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, like, it's so obvious to me that things are in such a desperate state out there. I would literally say that if you did absolutely nothing other than have bookshelves full of books, some musical instruments, dinner every night, Sunday as worship, rest, and celebration with the whole liturgical year, you admire your husband, your friends, you're going to have a great family, and they're going to be super successful in the way that God wants them to be. To me, this is totally self-evident. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be mean. But
I mean, to be specific,
yeah.
I mean, intellectually, I know this is superficial, but, you know, my parents had two incomes and one child.
Yeah, we have one income and seven children.
Just not,
yeah.
You know, I'm really not going to be able to provide them with exactly the upper middle class standard of living. But
oh, yeah, yeah. I know. Like, have you been to
Sometimes that's mildly embarrassing.
Oh, yeah. Honestly, so one thing is, you know, I don't know. Okay, so if you have been to a university recently, you will know for a fact that people are so uneducated, so I don't know what this education that they're getting. Yes, it costs them a lot of money, but that is it. There's no more to it. And the ones who got something out of it are precisely the ones who just had a fire lit in them and got something out of it. I mean, sorry. So then the question of, like, well, so our Lord came to earth and he chose to be born in a state of objective poverty. And by the way, it was not that Mary and Joseph could not afford to stay at the inn. It's precisely that our Lord chose not to be born in the inn. We have made a god of the upper middle class, wealthy life of ease and comfort. That's idolatry. And, I mean, despite your best efforts, some of your children will end up being really well off. Like, I don't know how it happens. Have you ever seen that Monty Python episode where the parents were the novelists and the son is in the coal mines and he comes and he goes, oh, Dad, I just really want to work in the coal mine. Where have we done wrong? Where did we go wrong? But it's a good living, Dad. I don't know how this happened. We love poetry. And I kind of look at my children and I'm going, I don't know, they're doing pretty well. I don't know how that happened. That God has a plan for each of your children, and if you do your part with his, knowing his law and knowing his will in the plan that he has set up, they will, it's up to them, then they will succeed or fall depending on their own free will. But there's very little you can do, having done those things, to frustrate a child's path. Like, basically, they're just going to go where they're going to go. And especially if you make sure to pray at every juncture. So, for instance, I mean, just out of my life, many is the time I did sit there being like, could this be right? Is homeschooling really the right thing to do? We're crazy. Why are we so crazy? And then just be like, Lord, this is you. I did pray about this. You did put me in this situation. I don't know. I didn't do a very good job of it. Here's this particular kid. Here's their needs. I cannot tell you. I mean, if we could later sit down and talk, every time that kid had a real need, a step was put under his foot, and he got exactly what he needed. I can look, and there's all different. So, you know, we just found ourselves in the place without even knowing about it, where this particular thing was an opportunity for this child. Just a matter of like asking and talking, and suddenly that step is put under their foot, and they have what they need to go forward. And the world is their oyster. I don't know. You just have to trust and follow God. Just trust and follow. Yeah.
So my question is, how do you protect living the liturgical year, especially if like when you're visiting family, especially if family kind of works together. So for example, like both of our families are Catholic. But both of them are Catholic in that, like, well, it's the right thing to be is Catholic, and we go to Mass on Sunday.
Right.
You know, and they live close enough that we visit often, and we're always there for holidays. And so we've tried over the course of our marriage to keep the liturgical year, to celebrate the seasons, but we kind of get bulldozed over when we're home. So is it worth it to be like, we are hosting and you can come? Mm-hmm. Or how do you protect that when you're spending 2 weeks over Christmas with your family?
Right. And as the children get older, it becomes more and more... but it also becomes more easy to say, we're just going to be here. And at least to protect, and I do have a lot about this on the blog, like living the liturgical year, which to me is not like making crafts. To me is like actually celebrating these actual feast days. And that's not really. We do have a lot of crafts because my mother is super crafty. So I have a whole closet with any possible thing you could want to do in there, like wood burning, whatever is in there. But but for me, it's like, did we live our Christmas? And like Christmas is a holy day. And so, yeah. And again, this is like every family is going to be different, because for me, it wasn't, there weren't like pullings of family. We really did get to be just us and make up our own. So there's a downside to that too, because you would love your kids to be able to play with their cousins and, you know, all of that, which we didn't have. But that, you know, your first duty is to your husband and to your children. So again, this is something that the husband and the wife discuss, open, free and frank discussion. What are we going to do? Here's the upcoming year. How are we going to celebrate it? And what are our strategy going to be? And how much do we go with what's going on there? And how much do we, like, we really want to go to midnight mass and they have all these things that they want us to do, or we're going to go on Christmas Day. And you work it out together. You make your plan. And the Holy Spirit will guide you, and you will see that if you just push back a little bit and you try to explain your reasons, then the families, you know, either they will understand or they just have to understand. But eventually they will come around, especially if you can kind of pull them in with certain things, you know, that will occur to you. I think that it's well worth it. Well worth living as, you know, if we think of ourselves as like the really simple Christians doing the Christian things and having the other people just like, yeah, no, really, we're going to do this. So, yes.
Regarding like friendship with your spouse, you seemed a little down on date night, but like what were some of the rituals that you and your husband have observed over the season?
I mean, I'm just down on date night as like, they said we have to have date night, so like rip the baby from your breast and get to pour your poor hurt uterus into a dress and get yourself out. Like, I mean, I literally know people who are like, the child is an infant of 2 weeks and then she's dragging herself and the milk is leaking from her breast and like, we had date night and it was so amazing. Oh, I just, all I could think of was the baby. Every time I thought of the baby, my milk came in. Really? Did you really have fun? That's what I want to know. Was it so wonderful? I'm just not convinced. You know, do I enjoy going out with my husband? Yes, I enjoy that. All I'm saying is that it just might not be like, just ask yourself, just say, do I actually enjoy this? If you enjoy it, fine, do it. I'm happy with it. Fine. But I'm just giving permission that if you don't actually think it's fun, that you're kind of like, yeah, no, we're not doing that. But what is fun? I don't know. I mean, so people have really fun, sweet, the people who are, give themselves permission to just not necessarily go for the quote-unquote spontaneous option, but just do what they actually want to do, seem to have a great time. Like, they go and they just pack a little picnic and, you know, the baby's on the blanket between them and they enjoy that meadow in the sunshine. Or a lot of times we just don't have the money. I mean, when my kids were little, we just didn't have money to go. I mean, honestly, like, living as a Christian, yeah, poverty is the way. That's how it is. You just will not have enough money to, do we have $120, $150 to spend to go out for one night? No, we don't. I mean, back in the day, when now we do, because we got rid of our kids. when we had just Bridget at home, we were doing something, and I was looking at my husband going, that's really true. When you don't have so many kids, you can do a lot of things. but how much more you enjoy them after that sacrifice? But so, you know, like even just watching a show together or just whatever, to lighting the fire or whatever. Like, in other words, it's up to you, really. But all I'm saying is, if all the magazine articles are saying you simply have to have date night, it's kind of like, why? Let's just question this for 1 second. What is it really all about? I don't know.
I guess I was specifically asking, like, what were your rituals? Like, did you guys have things that you really liked to do?
We just really enjoyed watching a movie together on the sofa together with the baby over there, instead of in there. And we really enjoy taking walks together. So just to say, like, especially it gets a lot easier when you do have, like, an 11-year-old, competent 11-year-old girl, just to be like, here you guys, you know, here's this thing I got for you. We're going to go take a walk. We really just enjoy talking to each other. So even just sometimes when we have to go pick someone up, like at the airport or something, my husband will say, I'm coming with you. Date night. So it's just like, we're just in the car together. We say the rosary together and we talk. And I mean, for us, our date night was like my husband looking at me, taking me by the shoulders. We had a bathroom off of our dining room. So he'd like take me off of, by the shoulders and walk me into the bathroom and shut the door and be like, I have something to tell you. And it would just be something like, you know, so today I got this package. Or you just wanted to say something to me. But I was so busy, like, sit down, don't do that. Literally would like push me into the bathroom and shut the door. That was our date night. Anyone else have any?
You've spoken to our individual families. Do you have any tips, especially having gone through it, about how to foster flourishing and encourage friends and encourage other families too?
Yeah, I do. And actually, when I was really thinking about this a lot a few years ago, I actually had the idea to start the St. Gregory Pockets. So if you go to my blog, you'll see a tab there that says, what are St. Gregory Pockets? And if you look at that, it has all the explanations, but I'll try to just give you a little summary. So basically, I think that most of us kind of have this little idea that, idea of like enriching our cultural life would be to have a book club or something with our friends, and maybe even like young moms will often have like Saturday night with their friends or something, and that's great. And I would just encourage you to look a little further and to see that, these friendships that you make are very good for you and very important, and they're also very important for 10 and 15 years from now, when those little children that you're kind of like getting away from on a Saturday night are going to be teenagers, and they need a peer group. And peer groups actually are very important. What's important, they are indispensable, but they have to be a good peer group. And the way to get that is that you've grown up together with other families, your families have grown up together, and you have had, basically you've had and talked about your standards in terms of this culture and how we're going to create a space, and you talk about your standards, and you may not totally agree about all the standards, but you agree that there need to be standards. I mean, it's to the point where I don't really even care what your standards are, just like as long as you have some standards. Because really, if people are just willing to make any sacrifice at all, that's just so amazing. Like, you know, I mean, talk about date night. I mean, this is the problem. It gets to be when the kids are 12. This is how it was in our town that we had to leave because I was like, my children are not growing up in this town. The parents are so used to going out every Saturday night that they don't realize that now they have 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds. So they're going out to have a drink, and they're leaving the 12-year-olds home. I got a letter from my school saying, just so you know, the sixth graders are like going and drinking, and I was like, sixth grader drinking? What? Well, then I found out that, yeah, they're like, the parents are going out to on date night, and the kids, because they're done. They're like, oh, he's 12. I can put in a movie, and it'll be fine, and, you know, he's 12, and they're done. And meanwhile, the kids climbed out of the, they climbed, they left the house, climbed in through the fire escape of some place and got some booze. And these are sixth graders, you know? And it's like, I mean, and that was quite a while ago now, but I mean, this is how it is. It's like we have this culture where the parents are like children, and so the children are raising themselves, and they're not actually doing a very good job of it because they're sixth graders and they're going out and getting drunk. So all of which is to say that that's the moment where you actually, you think the three-year-olds are hard. That's when you're actually like, oh, there's like a 12-year-old. We have to be doing something on Saturday night that's like good for them. And we need to be having a party, but the party needs to be, you know, there needs to be something for the 12 and 14 and whatever year olds. And they need friends who are really good. So those friendships that you have where you're actually helping each other, and, you know, your friend needs to go to the doctor, so you're watching her kids while she goes to the doctor. And you're having a special, when a feast day comes up, Martinmas, you know, comes up, you're getting all those kids together and having a bonfire and a little procession. And then, you know, they're on the bonfire playing and running around, and you're talking with your friends, but 5 years later, 10 years later, they still want to have that bonfire with those friends. I'm telling you, today, in today's world, there's no 17-year-olds who want to get together on Martinmas to have a bonfire. This does not exist unless we have, through the years, promoted it and protected it and made it so that, you know, we're just going to step back. Oh, you want a bonfire on Martinmas? Yeah, I guess we could do that. Yes, that's what they're going to do, you know? And then, I mean, this is, I've seen it. I've seen it with my kids. I've seen it now with my friends' kids who are younger. They're coming up. It's the fruit of many long years. So, yes, it's like that you're looking ahead and then you're saying, we have to create this culture that is wedded to the liturgical year and that has true, this is what I mean by celebration, like that the celebrations are really actually fun. You know, all these parties that they have at the public schools, they're not fun at all. And the kids have a very low bar for what fun is. Come to our parties. We have a great time. Like, that's, we're the ones who know how to party. Come on. Right? So that's it. I'll be available to sign and if you still have books and to talk some more. But thank you so much for listening.